On Saturday night in Washington, an armed man tried to run into the Hilton Ballroom, where journalists and politicians, including the president, were gathered for the 2026 White House Correspondents' Dinner. Shots were exchanged. The man was tackled well short of the ballroom. The guests, all unhurt, were evacuated. This has been, over the last few days, the biggest story in the world. And the would-be killer has become world famous. His name and photograph are everywhere, ditto his manifesto. Perhaps he's got what he was always after, fame. And will that inspire others to mimic him with perhaps bloody results? It's a question we ask all over again, not only after Washington, but now on the 30th anniversary of Port Arthur. Glyn Greensmith, a former ABC broadcaster, is a senior lecturer in journalism at Curtin University over in the West. His new book, Mass Shootings, Media and Motive, is a rigorous scholarly plea to all journalists to not give these killers what they want, the notoriety, the infamy. In it, Glyn traces media coverage 60 years back to the Texas University shooter in 1966 to show how newspapers and television adopted a familiar script, focusing on the killer, speculating endlessly, particularly on his motive, with, he argues, damaging consequences. Glyn, welcome to Late Night Live.
It's a privilege to be on here with you, David. Thank you.
Glyn, did you see the script, the familiar script, being followed in the reports of the Washington incident?
It's an interesting question to get us going. We are so hostage to the tumult and chaos from over there at the moment, aren't we? The answer is yes, I did. It wasn't a mass murder, of course. There's been an interesting script disruption. So script disruption is what we call it when there's been a change to the established reporting norms. And it is one of the reasons why today is a really important day, because Australia experienced one 30 years ago. And it is a script disruption that I would say to you is very positive, and I would say to you save lives. Similarly, since about 2018, maybe 2014, I can draw you a line. And I have charted a series of mass murder events in this country from 2014 to the Bondi Beach massacre. And I would say, particularly around 2018, we experienced the negative script disruption. We lost the things that we had gained after Port Arthur, and that Australia has become more dangerous ever since. This may surprise you to know that I've been talking about this subject for a few years, and I've had really interesting and positive conversations with my US colleagues about the coverage of mass murder, and a lot of them have been very proactive on this. I did a presentation to the NBC editorial staff on this last year, for example, and they were really on board with the principles of it. There is a big orange roadblock, and he's called Donald Trump. And what happened when Donald Trump came back in is the script kind of got torn up all over again. So from all the good work that had been done around being a bit more thoughtful, immediately Donald Trump got in, everything was political. It was political to start with, it was political to chase, and it was political in the end. And what happened was, it only mattered who a killer voted for. It only mattered who their affiliation might be. This was driven, of course, by that very strong propaganda arm that exists over there that seeks to say, see, they're more violent than us, the radical left lunatics, when in fact, you know, so much more of the violence has been done from their own supporters.
Now, Glyn, you have got onto your hovercraft and gone way up into the air, and I want to get you to come back down to the ground
yes, for a moment.
Because what you seem to be talking about is the development of a good script, and that good script gets disrupted.
Yes.
Did you see that disruption in the reporting of Washington? If so, what is it?
So what I'm saying is, it has been like this ever since Donald Trump came back in. Every killing is only political. And what that means is that every speculation on motive, every deep dive into a killer's life is justified through the prism of a political viewpoint that is incredibly damaging and incredibly problematic. And what it's done is it's reversed what actually was a pretty good trend. It's hard to imagine me saying this when we see so many mass shootings from the US, but they were actually working hard in the way that they reported it. There was knowledge and understanding of this concept, but it's gone out of the window. And this killing is a perfect, this attempt and this arrest is a perfect example. We are giving killers and potential killers everything they seek by deep diving into their life. And we have gone back to that script, and it is dangerous.
But Glyn, isn't our job as journalists to identify who these people are?
Sure.
What drove them to do what they did? What was in their minds? What made them raise that gun to their shoulder? That is all demanded by the public, is it not? And rightly demanded.
Ooh, yes, it is demanded by the public. We wrote that script. They didn't. The public didn't ask us. We created that, and we created it 60 years ago in 1966. So let me explain this two ways. Well, the question why is a really valid question. It's fundamentally a question that exists in the tenets of journalistic practice, right? And it is a reasonable question. And I have looked at mass shootings from 1903 onwards, the first mass shooting in Kansas, the second one in Germany, the third one, interestingly, in Melbourne in 1924. Every single one of the worst random mass shootings ever, every single one, David, has no formal motive. They never found out, ever. And what that means is, yes, we're allowed to ask the question why, but if the answer has always been we don't know, then it is not unreasonable for me to say, can we be a bit careful how we do this? Because the only thing we've ever known, the only truth we've ever found in motive that we've searched for, is when a killer has told us repeatedly and repeatedly they're doing it for the coverage that we give them. Because when we ask why and we don't know the answer, what we did in return was tell you every single thing we could find out about them. And they wanted that, and they told us that they wanted that. And that is the fundamental element of the script. And it was a noble endeavor, but we have never achieved it except when we ourselves are the answer.
Okay, let us go back. Let us go back and then face each other across this gap when we've looked at your study of shootings. Now, crucial to your argument is the shooting in 1966 that took place at Texas University. What was it about? Well, what was it about? There I go, asking the question which you say we must be very careful to ask. What happened?
Yeah, and it's called, and it's such a weird thing to say because it is not the first mass shooting. I just said the first one happened in 1903. So from 1903, there was a way that these crimes were reported, and it was very factual. And there were indications from the perpetrators that they were looking for something. There was always a grievance with society. There was always this grievance that they are not getting what they think they are worth. And they gave us clues, but it was never repeated in the coverage. It just was not part of the story that we told. And so what we saw from 1903 to 1966 was one mass murder event about every 4 or 5 years globally, okay? Once every 4 or 5 years, this event occurred. That changed on the 1st of August, 1966. When we covered the University of Texas massacre, and the only thing that changed was the way that we covered it. And it wasn't, a nefarious person sitting in a darkened room making evil decisions. There was this new thing called TV news, and there was competition between the networks. And they went, we need more. We need more striking visuals. We need a more in-depth way of telling this story. So they organically and collectively focused much more on the who of the killer, on the how of the method of the crime, and on that word why. And without the answer to it, they said, well, the only reasonable thing we can do is tell you everything we can find out about the killer. And they did, and it was widespread. Now, when I tell you that there were one mass shooting every 4 or 5 years before 1966, 1st of August, after the 1st of August, 1966, 15 a year, 20
now,
a year.
Yeah, Glyn, let's just focus for a moment on the Texas University massacre.
Yes.
It was covered live, was it not?
There were elements of it live, yes. There was still a lot of, as you can imagine, there wasn't a lot of juicy stuff that you were really allowed to show on the news. But there was certainly a lot of, you know, so there wasn't
you couldn't show bodies. You couldn't show people being killed.
Very, very conservative about that use. But what there was the question, why did this happen? And a news anchor would say to the journalist on the ground, what do you know? And the journalist on the ground would say, not much. Here's what I do know. And it's the information I'm getting about the killer.
And a great deal of it is just completely speculative. It's no better than guesswork.
Always speculative. I've seen photographs that were used on TV news of the killer as a four-year-old holding a rifle with the element of like a shoulder shrug of, is that the reason? I've seen interviews that were run saying, well, we know he had headaches. Of course it's speculation because they don't know. It takes a long time for investigators to go through information and find out. And I'm telling you, they've never come back with a formal motive except when they say, well, there's no formal motive. We really don't know why they did it, except they did used to talk about this idea of notoriety.
Yes.
So yeah. The why became the why. And we have talked a lot about this idea of not focusing as much on the killer. And that idea has come from all these different areas that look at mass shootings research, like criminology and forensic psychiatry. I'm not in that camp. I think you can and should name a killer and prevent disinformation. What we do is just think about how we're naming them and why we're naming them and minimizing that. And quite simply, if they've told us what they're looking for, can we not give that to them and still do our jobs? The answer is a resounding yes. That story was changed. It was created in 1966. And literally the phenomenon was born that day.
I am talking to Glyn Greensmith on Late Night Live about the ways in which we cover mass shootings and whether the way we do, the salacious way we do, inspires further mass killings. Glyn, you jump forward 20 years here and contrast the reporting in Australia, firstly of the Dunblane massacre, which took place in Scotland, and then the massacre that we are commemorating the 30th anniversary of, the massacre at Port Arthur. Now, what did you see in the reports of Dunblane that you felt had been corrected by the time, only a few weeks later, the same papers were reporting Port Arthur?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing to say is that I spoke to the forensic psychiatrist who analysed the Port Arthur killer, the man who sat next to him while he lay in that hospital bed, the man whose job it was to provide a court analysis and say, is this person insane, psychotic, fit to stand trial? Do you know why they did it? And he said to me, without Dunblane, there would never have been a Port Arthur. And he registered this man as suicidal. He was a gun nut. He was very interested in mass shootings and knew a lot about them, but he was suicidal. Something changed. So knowing that, what I decided to do was look at how Dunblane was covered in Tasmania. And the Mercury was the obvious example as the single state newspaper of note at that time.
Yep.
And I looked at all the coverage, and the coverage of Dunblane in Tasmania was all script. The killer featured everywhere. I looked at a story that was about all these victims were 5 and 6 years old. I was in the UK at this time. It was every bit the cultural shock and tragedy and turning point that Port Arthur was here. And when I found out about this proximity between them, I was so shocked, and that's why I decided to try and find out more. I looked at stories in Tasmania that were talking about the first burials of these little children. And next to that story about the children being buried, a photograph of the killer. What are you doing there? This isn't even about you. So the script was pure and clear. Who, how, and why, giving a killer everything he sought for if he sought notoriety.
Even if what he was seeking was to be seen to be a monster.
Yes.
And that is that script, isn't it? The script that you're condemning, yes, is the script that takes pains to paint the portrait of a monster.
I think the, I mean, it's 2026 and we look at who gets to be a billionaire or a president or a celebrity, and the idea of fame versus infamy feels pretty blurred these days, doesn't it? I don't know if it ever existed, and if it did, it doesn't anymore.
Not, Glenn, when the infamous are carrying a submachine gun and killing children.
Yeah, they see it as glory. And okay, there are clues in history as to tell us why, and we'll talk about those. So the script disruption you mentioned was really fascinating. It was not generated by the news themselves, and it wasn't generated by those in power. So for 2 days, the coverage of Port Arthur was very much on script all over Australia, and you will remember.
What do you mean on script? Sorry, Glenn.
Focusing on the killer?
Yes, right. Okay.
Speculating on the motive. Okay, so he had voices in his head, is a news article that was run on the first day of coverage of Port Arthur, and that wasn't true. Is he mad? And on the second day, and I think if I tell you this, you might well remember, no matter where you were in Australia, on the second day of the coverage, there was the front page of the Mercury was a big photograph of the killer, and the headline was, "This is the man." And you may remember that the Australian ran the same photograph on their front page and infamously coloured the killer's eyes red to make him look a little more demonic. What happened that day was twofold. There was a legal and a community pushback. The director of public prosecutions rang the leadership at the Mercury and went, if you cause a mistrial by telling, you know, this man is guilty before we've even been able to charge him, I'm going to come at you with contempt of court. Like, you do not do this. Do not ruin this, because this is too important. But one of the leadership team at the Mercury told me he's never known the phone ring as much as it rang that day. And he said what the message from the people was universal, and it was get that bastard off the front page. It was completely community driven, and it was totally organic, which almost seems alien to us in 2026. I think that people revolted and they told them. And what happened was the killer disappeared. Between those two reasons, I looked at 2 more weeks worth of coverage and I saw the killer's name mentioned 4 times. And crucially, David, all 4 times were purely procedural. No voices in his head. No, what breakfast cereal did he eat? No, what would have driven such a man to do such a thing? Just killer moved from here to here. Trial date starts to become known. Purely procedural, the script change. And do you think that they didn't cover that crime, or do you think that they then pivoted and covered the community response, the healing, the unity, the policy, the legislative? It was the victims, the survivors, the families. It was brilliant reporting. It was better reporting, in my subjective view, than when they were focusing on the killer. But it was disrupting a script, and I think it permeated into the rest of Australia. I think there became this revulsion of this man who sought to be deemed a monster, who was desperate to be known as the worst. He asked the police, while he was in custody, "What's my number? What's my number?" he said. And they wouldn't tell him. He wanted to know how many people he had killed, because he knew exactly what the record
was
and wanted to break it. And they wouldn't tell him. And I absolutely salute them for it. And he was incredibly agitated. And to my knowledge, he may still not know, because he's been denied news access during his incarceration. So he was desperate to achieve something. And the people of Tasmania drove a revolt and said, no, you will not get that from us. And when that moved through the rest of Australia, I believe, and other mass shooting researchers and experts in this area believe, that that was every bit as important as gun control in keeping us safe. And I can chart the return of mass murder to this country through the prism of, yes, us having more guns, but also us changing the story again. I think it kept us safe for 20 years.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Glenn Greensmith, former ABC journalist, now an academic, talking about the contagious effect of sort of glorious reporting of massacres. Glenn, was it in Jacinta Ardern's mind when the Christchurch massacre occurred, when she said, I'm not going to mention his name. We are not going to say his name. In Australia, we know the name of the killer of Port Arthur.
Mm.
But another step was taken by Ed Hearn there, was it not? Not even the name.
It was, I think, a beautifully human reaction. And I'll be honest with you, it was the reaction I first had when I became aware of this subject. It was an ethical, human reaction. The shock that happened for me was, what do you mean there is 30 years worth of research about this? I have a postgraduate degree in journalism. I work at the ABC. I'm now an academic. I think I would know this. And sure enough, I was like, holy hell, there is 30 years of research talking about this, and this is brand new information to me. So whether she knew it or not, she was tapping into something I experienced myself that actually turns out to be incredibly powerful. And that was followed in New Zealand by unprecedented collaboration between five news organizations who got together, and it was driven by Paul Thompson at RNZ. And they said, look, I know we're all competing, we all got to cover this, but how do we do this and not give this guy what he wants? Because we know what he wants. We know how he wants to use this trial. And they collaborated on some joint guidelines about how they would cover the trial. And it was just an incredible moment of leadership from all of them and collaboration and journalism in the public interest to say we can do our job without telling him we're going to give him what he wants, and more importantly, telling the next person that we're going to give them what he wants. The Christchurch killer, he murdered 51 people that day, that Australian man, 51 people. And the last thing he did before he got out of his car and began his massacre was open his computer and email his manifesto.
Yep.
To media outlets.
And he filmed what he was doing.
And he knew exactly why he was filming it. He had us as his last thought before he began slaughtering innocent human beings. They have made it very clear. And the lone actor terrorist is a little different from the random mass shooter. But in this, there is absolute clarity that they have told us repeatedly that this is why they are doing it. The Oslo killer in 2011 was the one who inspired the Christchurch murderer. And he, in his interviews, said he described the murder of nearly 70 young people, or 70 people, most of them young, as a marketing exercise. He said the deaths were designed to be atrocious because they're the fireworks. And I need fireworks in order to get the news to send my manifesto out for me. The truth of that crime was those young people did not die for whatever pathetic right-wing screed the manifesto contained. They died so that the news would send it out for them. And if we had disrupted that then and said, you will not get this, I put it to you that Christchurch wouldn't have happened.
Let's go to America briefly. Glyn, I wonder whether the painting of monsters in America has a political purpose, which is to try somehow to jolt the political process in the United States to do something about guns.
I think it is a noble cause, but it's an act of insanity at this stage.
What
to
is?
To say that gun control is our sole aim is an act of insanity, because I don't know, you know, insanity is doing the same thing again and again and thinking you're going to get different results, right? After the Aurora shooting in Colorado, which was kind of the mass shooting, the Batman one as it became known, gun sales increased by 40% in Colorado in a week. After the Sandy Hook massacre of children, gun sales increased. It's a noble goal, but I put it to you that if there are other avenues available to prevent the slaughter of children, are we not obliged? Are we not demanded to try? And people have criticized me saying you can't even talk about this because it takes the focus away from gun control. I don't know how many more guns. There's more guns than people in that country. there is historic evidence that tells us if we change the story, we can change the crime. That is real, and it is worth trying. 9 out of 10 mass shooters are not psychotic when they commit their crime. That means 9 out of 10 of them are doing it for a different reason other than an act of psychosis. If we can track that reason, can we prevent that reason? The answer is yes. Whether it be 9 out of 10 of them we can prevent, David, I don't know. But I tell you what, that's a number worth trying, isn't it? Because I'd do it for a lot less than that.
How did we go after Bondi?
Not good. We fell into the Trumpian trap of hyper-politicization. We stepped back on good practice. The ABC changed its editorial policies in 2019 after Christchurch around mass murder and were kind enough to tell me that my work was part of why. And they changed their editorial policies to say, you know, we know what killers are looking for and we want to avoid that. Can we try and avoid that?
Fame,
infamy. We want to focus on victims and survivors. We want to change it. We don't want to repeat the name of the killer unless it's necessary. Everyone went political. And everyone went that everything is fair game. I did a look at the ABC, for example, just on the just over the first week on the ABC website. I found about 50 articles referencing the killer's name. About 20 of them were about the killer, which means the killers were present in articles that weren't about the killers, that were about other things. And that was a return to the pre-editorial policy switch that wasn't good. And I think that the highly unsatisfactory thing that I wrote in the book, remembering, of course, that this would have been end of December, beginning of January that I submitted this, said, I don't like saying this, but this is now a more dangerous country and we are more at risk of mass murder events than we were before. Yeah. Since that time, we've had 2 attempted terrorist attacks just in Perth.
Glyn, let me put an ancient journalist's counterpoint. If we are to be safe in future from people like those Bondi killers,
yep,
we must know as precisely as we possibly can why they did it.
Agreed.
So isn't it a function of the press to investigate where they had been in the months before the shooting, where they were the night before the shooting? What took them to Bondi? Everything, every scrap of information that can keep us safe.
Yeah. So the answer is no, because it's making you less safe. Your question, your premise is correct. Your premise is correct is saying if we know why they did this, will it help us mitigate future events? The answer is yes. If we examine and ask why they did this by telling you everything we can find out about everything that they have done, the answer is we are now less safe because that's what they've told us they want. It is as simple as that. So here's what I would say to you. The investigation continues, okay? That it's happening right now.
There's a Royal Commission.
It will take a while. You know why? Because it takes a while. Like, things are hard. We never solve a crime in the first 48 hours. We never have like this and we never will. Because you can't. It takes people who dedicate their lives to it every day, months and months and months, to work out, and then they will present to us, if there is one, this is why they did it, right? And if they do that, then we can and we should report it. And we can do that without glorifying the killers, absolutely. I think that is essential information. How often do you think we've done that? How often do you think we have actually found out why they've done it and reported that 6 months later? It's never happened because they'd never know. They come back with no formal motive. In the meantime, the killers have said, gee, I hope you report everything I've ever done and everywhere I've ever been. The Lindt Cafe in 2014, which was a crime committed for the cameras. And it ended with the coroner's report saying this was ISIS inspired, and I and other researchers forensic psychiatrists and Middle Eastern experts fundamentally, respectfully say that was wrong. That was very wrong. He did it opposite the Channel 7 studios for a reason. He asked the police to provide him with an ISIS flag for a reason. And when he put that flag in the window, I'm told anecdotally and not scientifically by people who were reporting live, the number of cameras doubled in an hour. He knew exactly why he was doing that crime, and it was nothing to do with a foreign terrorist organization.
Well, Bondi is now in the hands of one of the finest judicial minds in this country, and we will find out, I think, in December, what we can know about the motives there. Glyn, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live to discuss this.
I appreciate it, David.
I've been talking to Glyn Greensmith, former ABC broadcaster, now senior lecturer in journalism at Curtin University, about his new book, Mass Shootings, Media and Motive. This is Late Night Live.